A quick note before we start. About 70% of all people who listen to the show on Apple or Spotify don't follow the podcast. If you like the show, please hit that follow button. It ensures that you don't miss an episode, and it really helps spread awareness of the conversations we're having. And if you can leave a comment or a rating, that's even better. Thank you. Okay, let's get back to the show.
Hi everyone, I'm Andrew Kitley. Please join me for brand new episodes on my podcast, The Invisible Gift, the show about turning neurodiversity into possibility. Last week of the podcast, I met up with my good friend, educational specialist Paloma Ford. In this episode, we discussed our new and exciting Invisible Gift workshops, which we're rolling out to schools across the UK. We explain the story behind them and our plans for the future, so make sure you listen to that episode. On today's podcast, I'm joined by homeschooling expert Jenny Sandler. Jenny is the founder of her business Homeschool UK, where she offers specialist tutoring to neurodivergent children, either who need more support to get through the British education system, or kids who have been forced to leave the system altogether. In the show, Jenny identifies why undiagnosed ADHD is a public health issue. We discuss why teachers in Britain lack the education needed to support neurodiversity, and Jenny reveals just how much the UK government actually spends on child's education. But first, let's learn more about Jenny in our own words. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's really cool to be here.
Do you want to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm Jenny Sandler, and I am a teacher by trade, but now I'm a learning specialist, consultant. I work predominantly with children and their families who are autistic, dyslexic, and have ADHD. And I have a small company called Homeschool UK, which started out because I was homeschooling children, essentially children with these learning difficulties who had been asked to leave their school. They needed somewhere to go. And while parents figured that out, I would come in and teach them at home. But now I sort of see Homeschool UK as being something about the home-school connection and relationship. So I'm not predominantly homeschooling children anymore. I do a whole bunch of different things with children and their parents.
Brilliant. So I've been dying, as Connor will tell you, to get someone on to do with homeschooling.
Oh, really?
So let's first of all, for everyone listening, I mean, homeschooling is an interesting subject. I have in the past said to people that I have very seriously thought about homeschooling, but I worry it wouldn't predominantly be me. It'd be my wife that would do it, and that's not fair pressure to put on someone. So for people that listen that might not be quite sure what homeschooling is and isn't, what is homeschooling?
Okay. So homeschooling, also kind of now known as home educating, is when you take a child out of a traditional school and you as the parent teach them at home. And it looks very different depending on who you are and what your philosophy is and how you view it. So some people, they take a very sort of progressive view, which can sometimes be called unschooling, which is when you let the child really lead everything and you're not so bothered when they learn to read or write and you explore nature and it's very free and wild. So that's generally not what I help parents with. The more traditional homeschooling is just going through the national curriculum, the standards at home, but often linking in your own interests. So yes, you're going to cover the expectations, but you can do it through activities of your choice. So through a lot of outdoor learning or cooking, you can do a lot of literacy and math and science all through cooking. So you can do it however you want to do it. You have a lot of flexibility like that. And of course, you can cover topics at the rate that's best for your child. So you can accelerate if you need to, or you can go slower and repeat more things. So that is basically homeschooling.
When I tell people about the idea of homeschooling, the first thing people mainly say is,
"You're crazy. Why do you want to do that?"
Well, yeah, that. And, oh, would you worry that your kid won't be social? Now, I'm going to ask you if these sort of things are right. Isn't it the case that most homeschooling, you put them into homeschooling clubs as well? Is that something you do? Or how do you kind of keep up the social aspect of that to peers their own age rather than just being socialized around adults all the time?
So again, it's really dependent on what you want to do as a family. Traditionally, especially in the US, people who homeschool tend to do so for religious reasons. And so, yeah, they probably do tend to club together with other families who share that religion and do educational or fun activities together. The families I've worked with here have all been what I would call, for the most part, they've been homeschooling not by choice. It's a circumstance. And yeah. So they have me coming in and teaching. If there's ever been another child that they can join up with, they've always been keen to do that. A lot of the time I would look for relevant activities that we could do, like an outing, but join with other homeschool groups. Mm. So there are lots of ways for children who are home educated to socialize. And there is definitely sort of a push for different group activities to share the costs as well as to socialize. But I wouldn't say that is sort of a definition of home education, that you pull your child out of school, you de-enroll them and then find a group or a pod, you could call it. In the States, over lockdown, a lot of kids did that because they were out of school a lot longer than we were here. And they formed these learning pods where someone would come in and teach a group of kids. But I don't think that's necessarily the way you have to homeschool, or doesn't define homeschooling, if that makes sense.
Do you see a trend of homeschooling increasing or decreasing? I don't know the statistics. I should have probably learned that before the podcast.
Yeah, I probably should have looked that up as well. You should have told me. What I can say is that I have been getting a lot more phone calls about homeschooling. So from my very limited anecdotal experience, yes, it is becoming more popular. I think COVID has spurred that on. Probably the majority of parents have, never want to look at another school book again and are happy to have their kids tucked away in school as long as possible. But there are a few who realize there are benefits and have now decided to switch over to that form of education.
So do you have a preference? Obviously, you deal with homeschooling and, like you say, it's home and school now as a connection. Do you think one is better for the other, or do you think it's circumstantial to people? Because obviously most people we have on the podcast are very, although understand the purpose of schools, are very against how education system is at the moment. Do you like one or the other more than, do you think there's much more benefit in schools or homeschooling?
So I don't have a definite answer. I don't have a sort of a philosophy where I believe one way is better. I can see the advantages and the disadvantages to both. I have three children in school. I prefer that they are in school. One of my children, I temporarily flexi-schooled because that at the time, that is what he needed. I can tell you from, again, referring to lockdown and all the work we had to do with our kids, that my children do not rate me as a homeschool teacher. I told them they just didn't pay me enough. So I really think it depends on the child, on the school, on your circumstances, on what you want to get out of education. And there's no right or wrong way. But I do sometimes get calls. I had one recently from a woman with twins, and one of her twins had just been diagnosed with central auditory processing disorder. I don't like the word disorder, but that's the title. And she wanted to homeschool him because school was struggling to understand how to best support him. And I said, but do you want to homeschool him? Yeah. No, she didn't. She had a job and she was coming to me. She wanted me to homeschool him. And I never want to talk myself out of a job. And I'm sure working with this child would have been really interesting for me, but it is prohibitively expensive to hire someone like me to homeschool your child full time, especially if I'm going to be doubling up as childcare and we're, you know, coming up with a very busy week. It's not really worth your while to do that. And I said to her, if I were to help you, I would really prefer to help you by coming into school and explaining to your Senko and to your teachers exactly what they need to do to support your child, because it doesn't sound like that homeschooling is the thing for you right now. So I get a lot of that where I do sometimes talk a family back into the idea of going to school because perhaps their motives for homeschooling are not as strong as their desire to do it.
But do you think that's because schools at the moment, I mean, I'm finding it because I go around to schools every Thursday. Me and Paloma go around to schools teaching children and teachers about dyslexia.
Yeah.
And the teachers are overwhelmingly not prepared for what's going on, because also there's a huge increase in diagnosis of neurodiversities going on, even in adults. Everyone's coming up to me going, I'm listening to your podcast, I've now got a diagnosis, I've got ADHD. I can't believe the level of people with ADHD now, how many there are. They're just everywhere. And obviously more and more tests are going on. Do you think, and when we go to these schools, the teachers are turning around saying, there's just not enough knowledge out there at the moment, and they don't even know where to start to get all this taught to them.
Yeah.
So are you finding that schools don't know how to break this information to the teachers?
100%. And this is something else that I do and really want to do more of, is going into schools and explaining dyslexia, autism, and ADHD, any of those sort of main neurodivergent conditions that teachers encounter. I have presentations, Understanding Autism, Understanding ADHD, where part one is explaining what these conditions look like, how they present, why we must support them. I mean, just as an aside note about ADHD, that mismanaged and undiagnosed ADHD is so, what's the word I'm looking for? It's so severe that it's a public health issue. It's properly a problem in this country that people who don't have their ADHD supported or recognized, you know, people with ADHD live less because, you know, you can engage in risky behavior or something as simple as not paying attention carefully enough when crossing the road. I mean, the prison population, 25% of the prison population has ADHD. And I don't know the statistics for dyslexia, but I imagine it's high. This is a problem. And we as a society and educators need to start supporting children from the very, very beginning so that they don't end up in prison or they don't end up with a shortened life expectancy. So to me, it's really important that teachers know that. And one of the other things that I do when I go into schools is I show them how they can support those who need the support without targeting those individuals. Because at the end of the day, there are way more people in our society or in a classroom that have ADHD or dyslexia or are autistic, and we don't know.
Yeah.
So what's the point of me sitting down in our, you know, in our classroom, in this room right here, and only teaching you in a dyslexia, ADHD friendly way, because he could have it too.
Connor,
and I don't
ADHD.
Know. Well, I'm just, you know, I mean, I don't know. And why am I now? I've got lesson A, lesson B. I'm just going to teach everything in a manner that is as inclusive as possible. And I think when you say that to teachers, you can do that. It's very scary because you think, but, you know, he doesn't need it. But actually, there are some very, very simple and small modifications a teacher can make to the way they deliver a lesson and to the way they even produce a worksheet that helps those who need it and makes absolutely no difference to those who don't. So really small example is enlarging the font and increasing the spaces between words and between lines. Now, I may not need that, okay? I don't have any reading difficulties. I don't have any visual perceptual challenges. You are dyslexic. That would help you. Connor over here may not be dyslexic, but may have some visual perceptive challenges and benefit from increased spaces. We can all read that same worksheet. It doesn't harm me to read something that's a bit bigger. The only harm in my mind is potentially the environment because we're using more paper and using more ink. But I think we can work with that. So it is a big, back to your original question, it is a big problem in schools. And what I find happens is I'm called in to work with the child. So a parent will hire me to help their child and I'll go into school and start pulling them out of lessons. And I shouldn't be surprised, but I always am surprised by how misinformed a lot of the teachers are with the assumptions they make, with the support they think they're giving, but it's not really support. And I like to kind of worm my way in there and show them what they can do. But it's like moving one tiny grain of sand at a time. I would love it if there was this movement to sort of shift everyone's thinking.
Well, I'm finding at the moment that actually teachers are using their own money and their own time to go and educate themselves.
Yeah.
That, to me, is a big problem.
It is.
And also, it is harsh to say, but I'm going to say that not all teachers are equal either.
No.
Because on my workshops we've been doing in schools, some teachers are absolutely engaged and fascinated when we're teaching about dyslexia and how to do things. And they've got Paloma, who's been doing this for 25 years, who's really well respected in her field, is there and can literally answer any questions you could ever imagine. And some of the teachers really utilize that. They run over and ask her as much as they can. And other teachers, it's almost like we're an inconvenience for being there because they don't think it's that important. And I've actually had a teacher say to me, I just don't see the value in it. And I'm like, you are what's supporting the future of this world. This is, and that's your view on something that's definitely increasing.
Yeah.
We had a professor that I think he was the one that said that neurodiversity is actually a evolution of the brain. And they haven't got the conclusive evidence on it now, but people in their field believe that actually it's an evolution in some form. And if we are going to, and that actually kind of tracks with the testing, if that is the case, we do need to change education right now. And like you said, not just for some, for all, because you're right. Anything I say about doing for dyslexic or ADHD people won't affect people, non-neurodiverse people. Or neurotypical, is that the right word?
Yeah.
Neurotypical people. So it's a tough one, but then that comes back to the whole issue with education. Really, what should be happening is parents shouldn't be coming to you, schools should be coming to you, government bodies should be coming to you and saying, how the hell do we change this? Because in your space, if I really been in it long enough, give me another couple of years, I probably will know everyone in this space. And I guarantee you, for the amount of people in this country, it's not going to be enough people in this space.
It's unfortunate. And I'm thinking about what you said about teachers not knowing or not always wanting to know. And I do believe that the majority of people who work in education, they really do want what's best for children and for learners, and they want to do the right thing. But the training isn't there. In a standard teacher training, you don't get the level of depth that you need to teach the variety of learners that we have. And I mean, I'm very fortunate that I value my education and I love learning. So I've done one master's degree in literacy, which was, you know, my dyslexia training. I'm nearly finished a master's degree in autism in children. You can't get that information from a standard PGCE. Yeah. So there needs to be more training. Schools need to provide more, you know, inset days, and but not just where someone like me comes in and delivers a session, but with follow-up, with workshops, with let me sit down with you and help you devise your lesson plans or your worksheets. And there, it's time and it's money and it's space. And the government is just cutting funding for schools. I mean, it is, I'm not, now maybe I'm getting slightly off track, but do you know what a school is paid per child?
Oh, I wouldn't even like to think.
Do you want me to tell you?
Yeah.
Okay. It first of all, it depends on what local authority you're in.
Yeah.
But in the London borough of Barnet, which is considered a wealthier borough, the government pays each school about £4,000 per child per year.
Wow.
That's not a lot of money.
That's not a lot of money.
Not a lot of money at all. So it's very easy to kind of blame teachers. But on the other hand, though, I just think they need so much more support.
I totally agree with Jenny here. The education system is in desperate need to reform, and because school teachers aren't given enough, they aren't able to support neurodivergent children.
Hi everyone, I just have a quick announcement that I'm really excited to share. We're launching the Invisible Gift Community, a platform designed to provide support and resources for neurodivergent individuals. I've always been passionate about sharing conversations around being neurodivergent, raising awareness and promoting understanding, but I want to do more. So now the Invisible Gift website will offer a range of tools and resources to help neurodivergent individuals navigate the challenges any one of us can face on a daily basis. This includes information about workplace accommodations, tips for managing sensory overload, advice on how to communicate effectively, information for how to get the most out of a neurodivergent child's education, as well as providing the building blocks for them to have a successful life and much more. But to do this, we need your input. We are looking for therapists, influencers, business leaders, HR, and brand representatives to provide their input and support. If you're one of these people that want to support neurodivergence, or if you just believe you can really help out, send my team an email on hello@theinvisiblegift.com and you can find more information on the Invisible Gift website. With your help, we can really turn neurodiversity into possibility. Okay, back to the show.
Coming up in the podcast, Jenny and I discuss if certain symptoms for neurodiversity present differently in women, and I also ask if there's a link between addiction and ADHD. But first, Jenny and I discuss what are the best pathways for funding in the education space.
We go around and do these workshops, and it's funny. I've got a lot of people that I speak to, like yourselves and other people that work in the education space, and they always say to me about, you know, I've got to try and get funding to do this, I've got to try and do that. And I've just taken my entrepreneurial brain and gone, do you know what? The government's not going to do sod all. And if I had someone from the government in here, I'd probably lay into them, because the more time I spend in the education system, the more problems I see, and definitely from high level government, and no one's really doing anything about it. They're saying they are, but they're not. But I'm now going to corporations to help fund it rather than getting schools to pay for it or government. They're jumping on it saying, yeah, we need more, we need better people coming into the workspace. So they're more up for funding now. So when people come to me and go, oh, Andrew, I don't know how to do this, I'm like, put a plan together, go to a nice big corporation that actually cares about this subject, and they will help you do it.
So when you're doing that, are these companies then looking for a specific sort of spin on the school? So a school that emphasizes art, or a school that emphasizes STEM subjects?
No, normally it's because they care about what you're doing. So if you went to them and said, I want to help people with neurodiversity in schools, that would help provide them better. It's a tick boxing exercise. The thing is, corporations work this way. Some care, but they also don't have the time to deal with a lot of things. So if they can put their name against a cause, which is incredible, they will.
Yeah.
Because that way they are doing their bit to change the world.
But it's less hassle for them. And that's how it works.
I see. Okay. But I'm assuming this is predominantly secondary schools, or you've got primary schools?
No, primary schools. This is mainly primary schools at the moment.
Really? Yeah. Oh, good.
Because if you think about it, if you're doing something that's amazing, which going to help in schools and change the education system without the assistance of the government, it's an amazing thing. And there's so many companies out there that only actually care about that. So they're like, well, it's going to benefit us because we're putting our name against saying it's good. You just got to make sure it is good. And that's how I've had to approach it. But a lot of people in this space go, right, I'm going to go back to the government. You're not getting any money off any government, whether it changes to Labour or anything. There's no more money. In education, it's clear it's too big to move. And in previous podcasts, I've had conversations and I've been very, very politically correct about education. And try to not slag off governments too much, the government too much. But in truth, they don't know how to change it. It's too big. They don't know how to do it. And not just them. It's the same when I talk to other people. Same in other countries. It's too big to change. And the only people that can do anything about it are private schools, but not everyone can afford to send their kids to private school. So when I speak to private schools, I've got one of the top private schools at the end of my road where I live. What they're doing blows my mind. Absolutely blows my mind how they educate their kids. And the kids that live on my road that go to that school are another level.
Yeah.
But that's not fair on people that can't afford it. But it's not going to change through government. So we need to do it other ways.
Yeah. That's amazing that you're hooking up schools and corporations. And I'm going to pick your brain after because my children's school needs money. But you said something before that I also feel quite passionately about is the expectation placed on schools and teachers. Maybe back in the day, school was where you went to learn your three R's, but it's not like that anymore. Schools are responsible for children's mental health and physical health. You know, if we have too much obesity in this country, schools are told they need to do more. If we have, children with, a lot of emotional needs, like everything. Again, I feel like I'm talking about COVID a lot, but it has brought up a lot of issues, a lot of mental health challenges. It's now for the school to deal with. And schools, a standard primary school is not fortunate enough to have a nutritionist and like exercise specialist to help battle obesity. They don't have trained counselors or psychologists on staff to support, the mental health problem. So it's all coming down to teachers whose training basically consists of classroom management and how to teach reading and writing. So it's not fair. You need more money, but not just money. We need to be able to pay for a really highly trained staff who can manage all the different aspects of education that's put on a standard school.
And it's not just, I completely agree, and it's not just the education, it's also the space. We don't have the space that works anymore in schools, as in the right kind of space. So I went around to a youth club recently, I went to visit, and they have, you'll probably know the room better than me, I keep forgetting the name, it's like a room that's really tranquil, it's got like certain lights, it's really comfortable.
Yeah, sensory room.
A sensory room, right? My God, I need that most of my life. And that's not even a joke. Seriously, I get
overwhelmed.
Sensory overload all the time. It's just so hard. Some schools have these, and some of the schools I've gone to have them, but they've all kind of done it themselves. They're just trying to find a little room where they've got that. And schools need to change because I'm a structural engineer and I do a lot of architects. In the next 10 years, you're going to see every office in the world change to suit different needs now, just different ways we work, not necessarily anything to do with neurodivergence, but just different environments, people's different mindsets when they come to work, how they feel. And they're all changing them at the moment. The newer offices are now in development where they're already doing it, and it will trickle down to smaller companies. But we're not doing that in schools where it really matters.
Not enough. We do it in special schools that are being purposely built for children, say, who are autistic. There is a whole field of architecture. I don't know much about it, but that works on architecture and design for autistic individuals. So it would include lower ceilings, different lighting, different ways of displaying furniture. But back to what we were discussing earlier, if it's good for someone who's dyslexic or if it's good for someone who's autistic, then it's good for everyone. And I personally think that most schools, but specifically classrooms, are completely overwhelming for anyone who struggles with sensory processing, and probably for children who even don't. But we just accept it as kind of schools must be bright and fun, and we have to have lots of different things to look at and lots of colors. But actually, no, we need calm. We need like beiges. We need lots of separate areas blocked off with walls so that you're not constantly distracted by what's around you. There've been a lot of studies about work and things displayed on walls, and you know, worst case scenario, they're really, really distracting. And they stop people from learning. Best case scenario is that actually you get used to them. So you don't even see them anymore. So they're not distracting you, but you're also not utilizing them as you're supposed to. So one of the things that I do specifically, if I have an autistic student and I'm going into school to support them and advise the school, I will give suggestions on how to modify the space to make it more sort of sensorily
sensitive,
soothing, to do with the lights, the sounds, you know, different chairs that scrape on the floor. But one thing about that, I had this with a school. They didn't want a child to wear ear defenders because they felt like it was too
distracting to the other kids.
Well, no, sorry, it wasn't that. They didn't want him to wear ear defenders. They were okay with him as an individual wearing ear defenders, but I had suggested that they provide ear defenders to everyone, make them optional so that child doesn't need to stand out. And because I know that we can all benefit from wearing ear defenders in a busy classroom. And the school had said, we're fine for him to wear ear defenders, but no, we don't think we're not okay with having them as an option for everyone else. And I was like, you know, okay, as I said to you before, one grain of sand at a time. I can't change the world. But now, this was probably 6 years ago. Now, in that school, ear defenders are ubiquitous. They realized they work. They allow those who want to use them, even if they don't have a formal diagnosis of anything. They have, I think parents still probably bring them in, but they have some available for those who need. So in 6 years, that's a good shift.
That's
but
amazing.
It just goes to show you that there are so many things we can do that we can offer that aren't a big deal. Like ear defenders really aren't a big deal. I cannot go into a school and change the architecture of the building to change the acoustics. That would be the ideal, but it's not possible. But I can say to a school, if you offer everyone ear defenders, that's gonna help.
Yeah, and I actually, that makes sense to me, because yesterday I went to one of the schools, and very common in schools is they have on boards all around the room, they have the yellow background stapled to the walls, and then they had like a red border that went around it.
And you just want to pick it off, right?
Oh my God. I was like, why would you have put that on a wall? And it was funny because I was saying to Maisie and Jordan, it kind of like, something that offends me is probably not the right word, but it was driving me mad the whole time I was in there.
It can hurt. It can hurt to look at something like
but,
that.
I mean, I said there's two things for it. One is obviously it's not good for people with ADHD. I don't think they're the wrong colorings, and I think dyslexia. I'm not sure about that. But for me, it was definitely frustrating. And secondly, them colors don't even go together. On a level, you'd never put red and yellow together. In any kind of color coding books, they are not two colors that do not ever go together.
McDonald's?
Well.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's true.
I think I found an argument for the success of the red-yellow combo right there.
Because people can't ignore it. So yeah, there you go.
Exactly, yeah.
That's probably why I love my McDonald's.
So. And if you're in that classroom, all you're looking at that display and all you're thinking about is your Happy Meal.
Yeah. But it's all around the room, there was just so much brightness.
Yeah.
And yeah, the temperature of the room was really, so the teacher made it freezing and the kids kept moaning how cold it was. And I was cold. If I'm cold,
yeah,
there's
then
a
you know
problem.
It's cold, yeah.
And one of the people as we said, can we turn heating up? She went, no, it makes them keep their concentration.
And there's a fine line between helping children stay alert by keeping the room cold and causing them to lose focus because all they can think about is warming up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Another way that I'm not suggesting teachers use this, but another way to help maintain focus is apparently to have a full bladder and need the bathroom.
Yeah, I have.
But again, it's the fine line between keeping you alert and stopping you from perseverating over the need to go to the bathroom. But back to classrooms and, you know, your hideous yellow and red, I think it's very personal. So to one person, that display might inspire and encourage, and to someone else, it might make you feel sick. Mm. And I think as adults, we tend to have an idea of what makes a classroom inviting. And although we were all children once and most of us were all in school, our ideas have changed over time and we don't actually know what's best, which tells me what's really important is for schools and teachers to really listen to their pupils. And student voice, pupil voice, agency is really important when talking about how someone learns, how someone feels in their environment, what makes them happy. And probably in a class of 30 kids, you're never going to come to a consensus about what the ideal display is. But I do think that children can feel very empowered by being included in these discussions.
That's also good for mental health as well.
Yeah.
Including children in any decision helps them out in the way they make decisions. I just think that's really important.
Yeah,
anyway,
it is. It really, really is.
Do you do much to do with mental health?
Not explicitly, because I don't have, I wouldn't feel comfortable talking about something that I don't have the training in. For better or for worse, it's very important that I'm qualified to do what I do. But there is overlap between mental health. And a lot of the things that I advise parents on supports not just the children's mental health, but the parents' mental health, which is really important because it's very hard for us to sort of do what needs to do if we're not okay ourselves. And I know that a lot of the routines I impose on my children are there because I need them. And that's okay.
Yeah.
So yes, that's kind of what I'm shifting towards is helping families whose children predominantly have ADHD or are autistic, and they don't really know what that means. They don't really know how to help. And my passion right now is executive functioning and how we can support a person's executive functioning at home and at school.
What's executive functioning?
I'm so glad you asked, Andrew.
If I didn't ask, I think my listeners would shoot me.
So our executive functioning is our ability to essentially manage our lives, am I allowed to say bad words on this?
Yeah, of course.
Keep our shit together.
Mm-hmm.
Without good executive functioning, we can be very disorganized. We can't keep track of time. We struggle to regulate our emotions, or we use emotions in inappropriate or display emotions in inappropriate situations. But there's a part of our brain, the prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for controlling this system, these executive skills. And ADHD, which we know stands for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is a terrible misnomer because it's not an attention deficit problem. It's a regulation problem. It's a challenge with the executive functioning. It's a challenge with regulating attention, regulating activity, regulating behavior. And so supporting that system helps support ADHD, but it is also common in people who are dyslexic to have problems with executive functioning. And executive functioning is huge. It's kind of the backbone of a lot of our neural systems and what we do. But you can have strengths and weaknesses. It's broad, like anything. So it's important to understand how we work and what we need boosting with. So working memory is a big one. The ability to hold on to information for a short period of time to use it. A lot of people who are dyslexic have working memory challenges, which makes learning to read really, really hard if you can't remember the corresponding sound for the letter or for the group of letters. Mm. Or it makes learning math really hard because it's, you know, you have to memorize your times tables and you're doing a problem and there's a method and you have to follow the steps in the method. So you have to remember the method. Then you have to remember the arithmetic. And by the time you've worked out the arithmetic and you've got your number, you have to then go back and what were you doing with that number? So if you have trouble with your working memory, learning is a big challenge. So that's something I particularly like to support. But I'm also aware that there are people who have ADHD, for example, who have incredible working memories. And that's kind of their, you know, invisible gift in a way. But if you kind of think of the sort of stereotypical absent-minded professor, this is someone who clearly functions at a high level and has all sorts of incredible creative and intellectual ideas, but you wouldn't trust them to cross the road on their own because you'd think they're going to look the wrong way or will have their, be very messy, covered with food because they've not paid attention to how they're eating. Mm. So this is, you know, someone who has executive functioning strengths and weaknesses all in the same person. So that's what I like to help parents support.
I mean, I can completely relate to that because I thought most of my struggles growing up was actually my dyslexia. But as time goes on, I meet more and more people, I realize that actually it's probably more a product of my ADHD, a lot of the things I struggled with. And now in my working environment, I definitely believe my ADHD caused me much more. I don't have really any issues with my dyslexia apart from short-term memory is horrendous. But
that's it. Your working memory, that's ADHD.
Yeah. So I don't, the thing I have, which is a lot of people always say to me with all my businesses and everything, how do you do it all? And I think the thing is my ADHD, I'll put things off, but I can also hyper-focus more than if I decide to go and do something that would normally take, I think most people months to do, I will do in a day or two.
Yeah.
And then people are like, what? We didn't have anything. Now we have a full set business plan and it's already halfway into action. How have you done that? But that's my ability to hyper focus on things when I need to. And ironically, I found the trick that if I set ridiculously short deadlines, my hyper focus comes into action every single time. Yeah.
One of these, you know, this big thing, time management and motivation to get started and procrastination is a big challenge for a lot of people. And I think if you understand that about yourself, like the way you've done, and you can harness it, that's incredible. But I do believe that for a lot of people, especially children who are in school, they need to be sort of taught these skills. Yeah. And this is what's great about developing executive functioning is that you can teach them. And I guess what I'm trying to say is there are ways to break down every task so that you could do it over the course of a month. Now, you've never worked that way and you're unlikely to work that way. But if you kind of could rewind and go back in time and teach your child self how to see through a project over a long period of time, it would be a useful skill to have. So that's something that I do think schools, another thing for teachers to have to do is to work on that type of training with kids. But again, thinking about that and harnessing that can also be used to teach core subjects like math and English, because a lot of children who have learning difficulties will look at a problem, will look at a math problem and not have a clue and not want to do it. But if it's taught to them broken down and sort of harnessing the power of executive functioning, and they're doing it bit by bit and having mini goals, so there are rewards along the way, you get that hit of dopamine, not just at the end, but as you go, because you've had a success and you've had a celebration along the way, you're going to get better learning outcomes from those people.
So how would, as an example, how would you go about doing that?
So, okay, so let's take a book report, okay? Mm-hmm. That's sort of a typical project you might have to do in primary school. So instead of a teacher telling the class, read a book, write a book report, you would give a very clear template on what you need to do for each element of the book report. So it'd be broken down. Step one, you need to write the title of the book and the author. Step two, please describe what happens in the book. Now, already you've lost someone, because to describe what happens in the book is too much. So you need to then, because there are templates. I'm not sort of saying this doesn't exist. You can get some excellent book report templates that will say step one, author and title. Step two, describe the book. Step three, give your opinion of the book.
I actually, the reason why I'm laughing is because I'm doing my chartership in engineering, and I've got to do my synopsis of the report.
Yeah.
Before I've done the report. So I've got to tell them what I plan on doing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, don't know. How the hell do I do that?
Yeah.
There is no sense to that to me whatsoever.
Yeah.
And I've had 10 people tell me, and I've had about 6 people share with me theirs, because sometimes it's easier for me to visualize what I need to do once I've seen what someone else has done.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so now I have to do the report first and then go back and do that second, but it's counterproductive to get my chartership. A whole mess anyway.
Yeah. Sorry. And luckily primary school children don't have quite that level of challenge. But so back to the book report, if you were to take that template and break it down even more and give very specific prompts to describe the book. So what was the problem or the challenge faced by the main character? Mm. How did the main character resolve that problem? And just give these prompts along the way so that, oh, I can do that. I can answer that question. And before you know it, you filled in your page for the book report, and it's not scary and it's not horrible. And every time you've answered a question, you're like, oh, brilliant, I've done it. And if you need more reinforcement, then you can have a checklist on another piece of paper so you can physically check off or strike off the bit that you've done. Or you can do it so that each bit is done on a specific day. Monday, you answer this element of it. Tuesday, you answer that element. So it's broken down and it's just not so scary and daunting anymore.
So really, it's the mantra to life. Take the first step.
Yeah.
I always say this to people when they're like, oh, how do you set up businesses? How do you do this? How do I do that? Take the first step. That's all you need to do. Because I think and if you just, it's funny, you've actually pretty much summed up, there's a Friends episode, that's it, when Chandler's about to marry Monica, and Ross breaks down the day leading up to the wedding, and he goes, right, all we got to do first is you've got to put on your shirt. I could put on my shirt, that's not scary.
Yeah. And then he goes all the
way,
right?
It goes all the way through it, and then obviously at the last point, the funny part was, right, yeah, what's the next step? Right, you need to get married.
Yeah.
And he freaked out. Yeah. But actually, as funny as that is the mantra to most things, right? So it actually kind of all fits in.
It definitely does. But I'm going to take it a step further. Ooh, see what I did there? I'm going to take the next step and say that knowing your first step or taking the first step is critical, but it's not enough, because you need to see the support is there for the next step and the next step.
Mm.
Otherwise, after the first step, it's then what? I don't know what I'm doing next, and I can still feel overwhelmed and confused and therefore avoid the task I'm trying to complete. So I think that you might not know what all the steps are, until you've taken the first step. But once you get an idea, to sort of plan them out so that you can achieve the, whatever it is you're working towards.
You, so you recently found out that you have ADHD. So how did that affect what you do? Or was that really helpful for you?
So I found out because I was working with more and more children and girls with ADHD. And I just thought, this sounds very, very familiar. But because my job has always been the educational side of things, you know, the reading and the writing, which wasn't something, thankfully, I struggled with, I guess it didn't occur to me that I could have ADHD. But once I learned more and realized what a broad condition it is and how it affects people in so many ways, I was fairly confident that I ticked the boxes. And when I went and got diagnosed, I couldn't believe how many of my qualities, the good ones and the bad ones, are related to having ADHD. Mm. So it was really quite an eye-opener. And I suspect that because of the way I am, it's why I relate so well to the children that I work with. Mm. And I related well even before I knew. It wasn't like I could share with them, oh, I'm like you, I also have ADHD, because I didn't know that. But I think I do also view things differently, and I'm always looking for an alternative way to doing something if the, you know, the mainstream method isn't working.
And do you find that it's actually the symptoms, am I right in saying this, the symptoms in women present very differently from men, but traditionally we've used men's measurements to find out people with ADHD? Because I find, I obviously talk to a lot of women with ADHD now, and their similarities between my experiences with ADHD are completely different.
Yeah.
So do you find that this information is coming out or being shared more about women's ADHD now?
Yeah, definitely. And we hear it in the media a lot. You know, there's this person's now come out as having ADHD and they've explained it. But the diagnostic criteria for ADHD is based on something ridiculous like 30, maybe 32 6- and 7-year-old boys. So it's not a huge number, and it's a very narrow sort of image of what ADHD is. And it's my understanding that the psychiatric community is trying to change that. But again, one grain of sand at a time, right? These things don't happen quickly. So when I have a student who I suspect has ADHD, but it doesn't present in the very typical way, as in, you know, bouncing off the walls kind of thing, I tell them, you know, I think your child may have ADHD. I suggest you see Dr. A, because that doctor, some doctors, just like teachers, have more understanding and view things differently. Some psychiatrists, they really understand that these conditions present themselves in a myriad of different ways, whereas others are just going to go through the tick list, and the tick list doesn't cover what we know ADHD to be. So you do need to make sure you find the right practitioner who understands that. But specifically about women, I talk a lot, maybe you've noticed, that is classic. I'm loud, my volume control isn't great. And when I was assessed, the psychiatrist asked me about that. And I said, well, when I was younger, I remember my friends used to either pretend to switch me off with a remote control, well, you know, they'd had enough of listening to me, or they used to turn down my volume dial, you know, in the old fashioned days, right? And the TV, you'd have to go turn down the knob. And I hadn't really thought about whether I spoke a lot or whether I was loud, but I had those memories which had stuck with me, and it never even occurred to me that that might be part of having ADHD. I have a very complex relationship with food, which is definitely associated with ADHD. They're doing more and more studies that are showing the links between obesity and ADHD for a few reasons. One being because, it's sort of impulsive. Mm-hmm. I see it. I want it. Doesn't matter if it's not good for me. Doesn't matter if I'm not hungry. But also to do with the feedback, like the need to feel something. Because if your brain isn't able to give you the right feedback from the dopamine, or there isn't enough dopamine, or whatever it is, but you get that from food. Mm-hmm. And that's why a lot of people who have ADHD do a lot of what we call risky behavior. So, a lot of sexual promiscuity, drug use, alcoholism, extreme sports, all of that gives you a rush. And we know that, carbs and sugar, binge eating sugar does that too. So that is connected. And I just had no idea that my complex relationship with sugar is because I have ADHD.
Is there a connection between that ADHD and addiction?
Yeah.
Because that's what I find a lot of people, I've realized now, especially as we've got older, is when we talk about ADHD, we realize that actually we have addictive personalities. Like this, it's really funny. I'll just give you an example. So I was just heavily involved in the Queen's funeral, all the structures to do with it. And we worked for 10 days straight. And in them 10 days, I drank loads of Red Bull, which I like Red Bull anyway, but I don't really drink it because I don't drink fizzy drinks generally. Right. And then because of them 10 days of having it, I've become overly ridiculously addicted to Red Bull. I am very quick at realizing addictions, and I wean myself off them. I just go cold turkey because I know what I'm like. And I actually thought that was just a my personality, but a lot of people who've come on the show says they have very large problems with addictions, and they have to kind of really control that.
So, yeah, it is connected to having ADHD. It's connected to, the feedback we get from something, and it feels good, so we do it. Mm. And then you get used to it. You become reliant on it, and it is habit forming. But what you said about, you have an addictive personality, you thought it was just your personality. I don't think we can separate what's our personality and what's caused by something in our brain that's a bit different to other people's brains. It's very much interconnected. Yeah. It's me.
I suppose that comes down to the marker of normal, doesn't it? Which is what we what is normal. But we always have that marker, and that marker's not correct.
Yeah. But I think that if there's something about anyone, whether you're neurodivergent or not, is that if there's something about you that you're not happy with, you don't want to be addicted to Red Bull, I don't want to be late to appointments, then you can work on it. Yeah. You accept that it might be more challenging for you to change that behavior, but it's definitely possible. We all have incredible neuroplasticity. Even, in old age, we used to think that once you're over 25, that was it. But we can change our brains. We can learn new things. It just may take a little bit longer.
So what would you say your invisible gift is?
I'm very generous. And sometimes to my detriment, actually. And I think that comes from having ADHD as well, actually. And just wanting to help people and share what I have, whether it's something physical or knowledge. I find it very hard to say no to anyone in need like that. That sounds really sappy.
Well, sappy is, sappy does. That's all right. You're going to go, what?
I'm going to be driving home and be like, oh, God, no, I should have told him about my magic skills that I can
do. It's all right. At least it was from the heart. And that's sometimes more important. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
That's all the time we have on the podcast today. Thank you so much, Jenny, for coming on the show. The subject of homeschooling and education when it comes to neurodiversity is fascinating, and you brought loads of insight. If you would like to find out more about Jenny, then you can visit her website at www.homeschooluk.com. Next week on the podcast, I meet entrepreneur and motivational speaker Lee Chambers. In the episode, Lee opens up about the illness that left him bedridden for a year. We discuss mental health struggles around being a founder, and Lee identifies the problems you can encounter if you go into a self-development spiral. It's a great episode, so we'll see you there. Just a couple of quick notes before we go. They're important ones. First off, make sure to subscribe to The Invisible Gift wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically be notified about new episodes. You've been listening to The Invisible Gift podcast, presented by me, Andrew Kitley, and produced by One Fine Play. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Kazra is the audio and visual engineer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Special thanks to Christina, Izzy,
Maisie, Jordan and Kate,
and the Cube Studios. Thank you for listening to the Invisible Gift podcast.